This is the Mason Vera Payne Show, your go-to lifestyle program, covering everything from technology and gaming to movies, TV shows, and pop culture to the supernatural and beyond. Brought to you by WGNRadio.com with your host, the unabridged millennial, Mason Vera Payne.
Mason Payne here live from the NVP studios in Chicago, and thank you for tuning in. On January 21st, 1998, Resident Evil 2 was released for home consoles. 21 years later, Resident Evil 2 Remake is released. Joining me to break down this remake is complex video game reviewer Hanuman Welsh. Thanks for joining me, Hanuman.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
So, tell me, why do you think Capcom decided to make a remake of Resident Evil 2?
Outside of the fact that it's just a fundamentally classic video game, I think the Capcom had gone so long sort of experimenting with the formula that was Resident Evil, you know, taking time away, changing location, character, format, even, you know, sort of game mechanics, but there still was this very sort of deep-seated nostalgia for Resident Evil 2 because it meant so much to so many people who are of a certain age that are now being like, God damn, I really wish I could go back and play that game with a fresh coat of paint.
Why not call it reimagined instead of remake or even a director's cut?
They did release a 1.5 director's cut that was, I think, released on GameCube. And I would even hesitate to not even call this a remake. I mean, it's almost a full rebuild or reboot. I mean, it is the game frame for frame with all of the same art assets, but it is taken on an entire new life of its own. But everything there really just strikes a chord of familiarity, whether it's, you know, this police station that also doubles as, you know, some sort of like secret bunker mansion where you have to solve puzzles to get from room to room and progress through the game. But I really wouldn't even hesitate to call it a remake because it's really not. It does have its own identity.
Now, the original Resident Evil 2, I can't help but to remember that it was chock full of puzzle rooms. Mm-hmm. And in this particular game, it feels like 50-50. It's half puzzle, half a little yes. Shooter. Did you get that too?
100%. I mean, I feel like a big part of the original release's identity was it was a horror survival game, thanks largely in part to the fixed camera, right? We it was a very cinematic feeling game, and, you know, the background was almost sort of used as, you know, like place setting. And so there was an emphasis on puzzle solving and this very sort of like cat and mouse approach to combat. You had to be very, very picky about how you wanted to go through your resources. And puzzles were a huge part of that. You know what I mean? In order for you to kind of progress through the game, you had to remember where you were, where you're going, what you've seen, and what you still haven't seen yet. With this game, with the 2019 remake, you know, it really has evolved into a horror shooter, right? Where the fixed camera is gone, and now we're back to this very sort of straight-up, over-the-shoulder, manual-aim shooting game. And yes, puzzles are still present, but not really to the same extent that they were in 1998.
Okay, so there are a few things that bothered me about this game, and maybe I'm being superficial, and let me know if I am. The fixed camera, not having it, that kind of bothered me. Did it bother you too, or no?
You know what? I remember so vividly how janky it was back then. You know what I mean? Even when this thing first came out, I was like, I really wish it would stop flipping the entire perspective of my character just because I turned a corner. Oh, I think people had a very sort of nostalgic investment in that, like yourself, because it did feel cinematic. And I feel like a little bit of that magic did get lost because of, you know, the fact that there is just a sort of over-the-shoulder camera now, but I do feel like it's hard to be mad at it when the game looks and plays this well.
Okay. My next one was, zombies can go through the doors. I don't know about you, but I remember that was always my Hail Mary. If I got overwhelmed, I can go back into another room and let it reset. But in this case, the zombies go through the door. They're like, hey, you're not leaving. That bothered me.
No. Yeah, I think there were a couple cheeses back in the day that you could kind of take advantage of the processing power of the PlayStation and sort of the clipping of you know, seeing a zombie's arm kind of magically move through a door. But I think, they overhauled sort of behavior of your enemies, and I think they approached it in a really smart way that made players in 2019 feel like they're actually being challenged.
Yeah, it was a challenge because when that happened, I was like, whoa, what's going on here? I couldn't believe it. I was like, I thought this was a remake.
No, they're smart, somehow smarter zombies, but still, you know, still so many of them.
All right, so I'm not really sure of if this happened in Resident Evil 2, but, you know, nostalgia can be fuzzy. Were the headshots easier in the original game than this one? Because I was getting headshots, and the zombies wouldn't go down. How many bullets does it take to get a zombie to go down?
The strategy that I've come across and that I've always maintained is you shoot them in the knees. You take them out using whatever weapon you have, and you can take out their kneecaps, and then you can stomp in their heads, thus saving yourself a couple bullets. And I think a big part of that sort of that strategy, both in the 1998 version and the 2019 version, is auto aim versus manual aim. In the original game with the fixed camera, you had an auto aim, because if you didn't, it would be an impossible game. You could kind of aim up or down, but that was about it. There was no fine aiming. But in this 2019 version, there is no fixed camera. So, yeah, I think they had to make it a little bit more difficult that it wasn't just a single shot, single headshot to take down a zombie, or otherwise you'd blow through the game kind of quick.
That is true, because I would have just been saving my bullets, because that's my number one concern, is that I'm not going to have enough bullets for whatever reason.
I mean, but I think that's a perfect element that kind of translated from the original to the remake, right? You are conscious of your resources. And a lot of shooters, especially zombie games, you know, most of these enemies are just bullet sponges.
So what is something you like about the game, like something that really stood out for you?
I think all of the emotional cues were there for me, you know what I mean? I knew when the first time I was going to meet a character, or I knew the first time I was going to encounter an enemy, I knew it was coming, but it still felt new, right? While still scratching that nostalgic itch, and I think that's probably one of Capcom's biggest accomplishments.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. That was really wonderful. I knew exactly that, you know, everybody's going to get separated at this point, or this is going to happen at that point, but it still felt like I was new to this, and I really enjoyed that. And plus, the cinematics of it was really nice, too.
It's a gorgeous game. They've done a beautiful job reimagining all of the art assets from the original title. And like I said, you walk in and it manages that rare trick of feeling old and new at the same time.
Okay, so this game sold over 3 million copies within the first 3 days of its release. Do you think with this kind of success that video game developers are going to sit there and say, hey, we need to remake more classic games?
I mean, look at the strategy Disney's doing right now, where they're doing live-action remakes of shot-for-shot classic animated films. I mean, I think it would be silly for some companies to not revisit titles that they know that fans would flock to. I mean, a perfect example is Tony Hawk's Pro Skater. The last one, Pro Skater 5, was not good, I think, and I'm being charitable by saying that, but you have the first three or four games that are held up in, you know, who owns which IP, but if you were to somehow remaster those, remake those from the ground up for a new audience and returning audiences, I mean, I feel like if you're a publisher, why wouldn't you want to inspect that?
I love that you said Disney, because I want to know, what are your thoughts on Kingdom Hearts 3?
Kingdom Hearts 3, it's a lot. I guess it is doing the most. It is, you know, it is a game 17 years in the making, and, even the title is misleading. Kingdom Hearts 3, I mean, it's not even really the third game in this series. I mean, we're looking at, let's see here, I think it's something close to, I think, a total of 10 games between three different systems over 17 years, more than seven games, six different video game systems, and now here we are with the third main entry of Kingdom Hearts nearly 17 years after the second main entry. And, you know, it's a hard sell. I mean, it's a hard sell for fans to ask to be waiting that long between entries. And, you know, even conceptually, like, the elevator pitch is kind of, you know, okay, Final Fantasy meet every single Disney character you can think of. That's going to appeal to a lot of people, but a lot of people are going to be very confused.
I actually love that concept. I thought it was the coolest thing, because growing up, to me, this was like fan fiction. They just threw this 100%. Ship together, and I was on board. I was like, let's sail away. You got me. But
It really does. This is one of those games, like a franchise that I would say that people are as emotionally invested as maybe like Halo. You know what I mean? This is one of those things that people wait for, and, you know, again, fan fiction is like a really, really, really good way to put it.
You know, though, I will say they lost me. They lost me years ago, way back in probably 2008, 2009, when it was 358 over 2 days. Was that it? Is that the game?
Yeah.
They lost me there. And I haven't played a game since then. And the reason why is because I was waiting for Kingdom Hearts 3. So you got to catch me up a little bit. Where does Kingdom Hearts 3 fall within the timeline? Or do you know this one?
So you're really starting in the deep end with the chronology of it, because the previous sort of sidequels and prequels and reboots kind of have put players in the role of the past, the present, the future, and this game kind of starts off where two left off, but kind of not too distant in the future. And that's about as close, that's about as succinct as I can make it, because really, in true JRPG style, it is a lot to keep track of. Characters, times, places, who knows what. Oh, remember earlier in the previous entry of the game, well, we shattered that time crystal, and now we're actually in a completely alternate timeline where those two characters haven't met yet. So I really feel like focusing on, you know, sort of the elements that spoke to you about this series in the first place, the main entries for me at least, is really how you're going to get the most enjoyment out of this title.
So you're telling me that just jump into it. Don't even try to play the other games. Just if I want to enjoy it, just try to enjoy it.
I feel like Disney and Square Enix did this amazing job where they know that the barrier of entry for this is going to be particularly high for new players, right? So they wanted it to be a relatively easy entry point for people who are new to the franchise. I mean, how do you... So, and of course, that's the real pull of this, is that not only are you playing as the main character, Sora, who is sort of like a JRPG 101 character, but, you know, you have Goofy and Donald Duck by your side the entire time, and you travel from Disney planet to Disney planet, inhabited by basically all of the denizens of each of these films. So there is that emotional, like, nostalgia entry point for new fans of the series, right? So if I don't know anything about Kingdom Hearts, but I love Toy Story, I'm going to love this game. If I don't know anything about Kingdom Hearts, but I know every single word to every single song from Frozen, fantastic. They've got something for you there as well.
Do you think this game will have any DLC?
I hope so. I don't see why it wouldn't. I mean, it's not like Disney's going to stop making games or stop making films and tying them in, you know what I mean? It does seem ripe for DLC, but I feel like since we've waited 17 years for the third entry in the main series, like, I mean, I've already dumped, I think, 30 hours into this, and I feel like I didn't even actually get the good ending or the real ending. And so I feel like Square Enix isn't really one for DLC, but I feel like, you know, Disney as a co-publisher would probably, you know, be fine on that idea.
So you have 30 hours invested in this game, and I'm wondering, at any point did you sit there and say, why didn't they just reboot the game, restart it halfway through and say, boom, brand new series?
Again, this goes back to you talking about fan fiction. I feel like people were so invested in the character's development and the arc and the story. I think it would also, I think you would have made more people furious by being like, JK, the next Kingdom Hearts you're getting is a reboot, after people have been clamoring for a third entry for the better part of 2 decades.
Yeah, you're right. I probably would have been like, I'm done. I'm done with Square Enix.
Yeah. We're all done.
All right. So in the past few months, I've been hearing these rumors that Amazon, Verizon, and now even Google, they want to do their own little platform or their own console. What's up with this? Why are companies jumping into the pool now?
We will probably, more than likely, see the demise of physical media in the gaming space in our lifetimes. I think for publishers, the production costs of printing, manufacturing, you know, discs is pretty high and in marginal as we head into the digital era fully and completely. And so you know that Google and Amazon, they know that you have a streaming device in your home, whether that's an Apple TV, whether that's an Amazon console, and they know they've already got a foothold in your home because they know you're streaming movies. They know you're streaming television shows. And so it makes sense for them to get you to stream games without having to purchase a separate console. Why are they going to let you walk out the front door and go buy another Xbox when they can just be like, hey, we stream games now, and you can just go pick up a $30 controller, and now we are your one-stop shop for everything entertainment?
I can see that. That makes a little bit of sense. But this is the companies talking. Do you think the consumer wants... They don't even own anything at this point. I'm not sure I want that. I kind of like knowing that I at least have a digital library or I have a physical copy. But in this case, they're just saying, hey, $9.99, you're going to subscribe, cancel anytime you want, but you won't own the games. I'm not sure I like that concept. Is this the companies telling me, no, you're going to like it? Or am I just kind of archaic?
I mean, I think it's a question of philosophy, right? It's a philosophical question of whether or not, you know, physical digital ownership is actually something that you possess, or is it something that a company possesses? I think the biggest hurdle in getting people to fully adopt a streaming video game platform is going to be quality. It's going to be your ability to stream things, and it's very easy to stream a Netflix film or a movie. It's a file, right? I'm just playing this thing, I hit play, and I sit back. Whereas something like the PlayStation Now Network, which I've tried to enjoy in the past, I keep coming up against lag, I keep coming up against latency issues. I think the whole thing is dependent upon your Wi-Fi and your internet connection, and I feel like that's the biggest hurdle, because my wife was even trying to go back and play the original Katamari on PS Now, and she had to like throw her hands up. She's like, this is terrible. She's like, I can't play. I think we still have a little ways to go before there's a full adoption of video game streaming platforms as a complete replacement to consoles, but I think console generations are sort of shrinking in such a way that they almost have to become modular, you know what I mean? Like, the Xbox is essentially a PC, and you have to be able to give people the ability to sort of upgrade quality the same way a PC owner would, who are console owners. So it's definitely a pivot point. There's definitely a very interesting moment right now in gaming to see where the industry will go. But for me personally, I do buy my games digitally, and you know, I bought Red Dead Redemption 2 physically because I wanted to make a point about it and be like, I'm going to own my own physical version of this game. And of course, what happened? I lost the disc.
How did you lose the disc?
My 18-month-old son ejected it from the PlayStation and slid it under the console.
Oh.
I found it. It's fine. It works. But that goes to show me for making a point.
Your kid's like, and here's your point right here.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, and I think, you know, the thing that about digital ownership is that, you know, for example, Sony, I have a library. You know, if something gets deleted, you know what I mean? Essentially, there's my receipt. And I can re-download it. But a lot of times that doesn't happen. There was the recent Lego Hobbit game that was taken down. And even if you owned the game, it had been taken down from all digital services. So even if it were in your library, it is now gone. If you own a physical copy of it, that's great. But if you own a digital copy of it, it's gone.
I didn't know that. What happened there?
I think it was a licensing issue with Warner Brothers. Somebody wanted more money, and the other person was refusing to budge, and so they just scrapped it and just said fine.
Well, there you go. Well, thanks, Hanuman, for joining me. I really appreciate you being here. For those listening, where can they find more information about you?
On Twitter, at Hanuman Welch. I'm there pretty much 24 hours a day.
This has been the Mason Vera Payne Show. Thanks for listening. Can't wait to hear more? Subscribe, rate, and comment at masonverapaine.com. That's MasonVeraPaine.com. Also, follow Mason on Facebook and Twitter at Mason Vera Payne. That's all one word. And don't forget to share the show with your friends.